Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
On Warriors 6.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. Michael Snowhawley.
That is correct, the Buffalo Snowhawley.
It's stuck in Buffalo right now. Well, it could be worse. It's good for you.
Yeah, a couple of my friends have over 3 feet. We have about a foot and a half where I'm from.
Well, that's good. So, that's good. It gives you an excuse to be stuck in and drink.
Oh, yeah. Then I get to drive my brand new 5.7 liter Hemi Dodge or truck, Ram truck. So I'm all psyched.
All this man stuff. I'm sure the wife will scream at you. You'll be driving. You'll be doing all these wheelies and all this stuff out there, and you're not supposed to be.
Oh, yeah. I don't tell her a thing.
No. She doesn't know it won't hurt her, right?
That's right.
Because if she knows, it'll hurt you.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Remember, she's a karate expert. So.
Yeah, she was a nationally rated judo player in her younger days, so I am afraid of her.
You? I would be, too. I'm afraid of her back at West.
That's right.
Kill a man at 10 paces, that's for sure. Well, anyway, here we go. We will be talking to... a writer who used to be, I believe, a cop. So let's find out what's going on here. We got Mr. David Putnam. So thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the show.
Dave, so where did you come from? It looks like law enforcement. So we like to go over the cops hard here. Who were you before? Let's talk about this.
Well, my dad was a deputy sheriff, but he left, separated from my mom before I was old enough to understand that. So I don't think he had an influence on me. But I started as a sheriff's explorer when I was 15. Went to the Sheriff's Explorer Academy. It's like Boy Scouts. I'd run on ride-alongs, that kind of thing. Then I applied and was hired as a police cadet for Ontario Police Department. Ontario is a city of about 100,000 in Southern California, about 40 miles east of Los Angeles. I did 2 years as a cadet. Then at 20 years old, they hired me early, and I went to the academy. And I did 4 years in Ontario, and I wanted more action, so I laterally transferred to L.A. County Sheriff Department, did 6 months in the jail, and went out to the streets and worked 4 years in South Central Los Angeles. Then I transferred to San Bernardino County Sheriff Department, where I did 22 years working a variety of just details, violent crimes, did two tours on SWAT, internal affairs, criminal intelligence, narcotics, that kind of thing. I retired with 22 years there, and then went to work as a special agent for the state of Hawaii as Hawaii 5-0. attorney, the state's attorney general's office. Then after 3 years there, retired and came back to California. I started writing in 1989 when I was on a job, and that was on my 30th manuscript before I sold my first book.
Wow.
That sounds right.
So you
it were, is that tough.
You were the Bookum Dano on Hawaii Five-O.
Yeah, my wife started calling me Dano while we were there. But I would come to work, and I'd find the fake Hawaii Five-O car actually parked in my slot, right where I was supposed to park. One time I was on the phone and we were having a fake shootout outside my window. I was talking to a witness on the phone.
Well, that's good. You know, I'm watching the old ones right now from the original late 60s, 70s.
Oh, the old ones.
I think the old ones were better. They were closer to being real than the new ones. The new ones just get way out of hand.
Yeah. 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 In Miami Vice, it took a turn and everything is very flashy now. I like watching the old ones. I'm watching the old Mission Impossible and the old. I'm kind of getting into all the old ones while I'm working. I like it. It's a little more raw. Even the Kojak. Kojak is pretty impressive. I didn't realize how good that series was until just the last couple of months when I've been watching it. So surprising, you know.
Yeah, Kojak's one of my favorites as well.
Yeah, I'm really getting into it. I'm in season two now, and I'm thinking this is really, it's really done well. It's really, because I think that the characters, the police, are real people. They have real problems. It shows them as they make mistakes. They're just humans, and they're doing the best they can. And I think it showed that better than what they do nowadays, because now they're all superhuman. You know, like they don't have a whole lot of personality or something. I don't know.
I think the writing was great on Kojak too.
How about Tom Selleck though?
Oh yeah, I like Magnum PI.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Or are you talking about the MIT?
No, Magnum PI. Yeah, because I actually lived in Hawaii for 3 years. Yeah. I was stationed. I was a helicopter pilot, so I was stationed in Hawaii. So I lived on the North Shore and stuff. So, but it was all about Magnum PI when I was there.
Yeah. You even had a mustache, didn't you?
I did. I absolutely did. And I had tennis shorts and they were the short ones. That's right. Just like Magnum PI.
There you go. You're a nut. So when you're still on the job, that's interesting. And then, so you had it in your mind that you wanted to actually sell the books and become an author when you were still a cop.
No, I started off as an avid reader. And in fifth grade, I think I got the reading bug from my fifth grade teacher who read to us after lunch every day. And that's when I picked up books and I haven't put them down since. And I tried to write my first novel in junior high school, and I tried to write two more in high school, never finished them. And then I became enamored with law enforcement. So I kind of went a different way. Because, you know, they gave me a gun and a badge and a fast car and said, go chase crooks. I mean, what you play cops and robbers and they pay you. So, I kept books in the backseat of my undercover car. This was in 1989 novels. Because on a surveillance, it's not like in the movies or in the books where everybody's watching one location. One guy watches, they call him the eye, and then everybody else is laid off until the person, the target moves. So when I wasn't on the eye, I got to read a book. And so I had these novels in my back seat. So now, you know, they give me a badge, a gun, fast car, chase crooks, and I get to read on the job. I mean, it was just a perfect job for me. So I was on a meth lab surveillance out in Mojave Desert, the CERN Valley, way out in the middle of nowhere. And I was down to my last book in the back seat, and it was the second book of an author who his first book was an international bestseller. And I really liked the book, so I figured this book was going to be just as good. What I found out later, after I got into it, was that the sophomore effort of the books many times are not as well done as the first, because the author will work on a book for 10 years, rewriting it, polishing it, sending it in, getting comments, rewriting it again until he finally sells it. He or she sells it. And then they have a contract for the next book and they have 1 year to write it. So that's what happened with this book. This book was an absolute dog, but I was a captive audience. So I had to read the whole thing. And I read the whole thing, and I got done. I thought, oh, I could do better than this. So I wrote my first four novels on the front seat of my cop car during surveillances. and I realized very early that a good author makes it look easy, because it was a very difficult endeavor. So 38 books later, from 1989 to 2014, I finally sold a book, which was The Disposables, this first book in the Bruno Johnson series.
You have quite the background for these books.
And I put a lot of real life stories within the books. I use my experiences, and I put the reader right there on the scene. What I saw, what I smelled, everything that happened.
That's important, I think, in a good book or a good story, because it reads as true, like it's believable, and it comes across that way. People can feel it. Yeah, whether they like the characters or not and whatever the story, but it's still real. But you also, in this case, you're putting a lot of yourself out there for the public to see, you know, and in today's world, it's pretty savage, and it's easy for people to respond in good and bad ways. And that's always not always pretty. That in itself is a different sense of courage. Like it's a different type of courage, but you're still doing it. You're in a way, by putting yourself out there, because there's a lot of you in your characters, I can imagine.
Yeah, each book of the Bruno series was like a snapshot of my career, because I did a lot of diverse jobs. I was even cross sworn as a U.S. Marshal, and I chased murder suspects across three states and followed bank robbers around. And one time, six murder suspects escaped from our jails, and I chased those guys. So each book, I did one for narcotics, I did one for bank robbery, but it's the Bruno Johnson, Marie, and his dad theme. Bruno Johnson's an ex-cop, ex-con, who rescues children from toxic homes. He couldn't do it when he was a cop because of the rules and regulations. Now he goes outside the law to rescue the children. So in each book, he continues to gain children. And he has a makeshift orphanage down in Costa Rica, and he keeps coming up to the States to handle these conflicts that I throw him in.
So he's basically a good guy, but he's doing things outside the law to do the good things.
Yeah, yeah. He's doing things that are legally questionable, sometimes obviously illegal, but he's doing it for the right reasons.
Well, so now this new book here, A Fearsome Moonlight Black. Now that's a Dave Beckett novel here. When you're doing a series like this, this is book one of one. How do you kind of keep track of your character and what you're doing with them and the scenes? I mean, it's only book one here, but when you go further into it and in other series, what's your method?
Well, this book, my publisher for Bruno Johnson will only take one book from me per year. And I write faster than one book per year because I wrote 38 manuscripts. So I've got the structure down. And I can write pretty quickly now. So I got caught up with Ocean View, and I'm two books or three books ahead of them now that they have backed up. And so I wanted to write a memoir, and I couldn't get the story arc to work because I was too close to it. So If You're Some Moonlight Black is actually the first half is memoir. I wrote it just the way it happened, my first year on the job. And what I wanted to do was what Joseph Wambach, quote from Joseph Wambach, who was one of my people that got me into reading and writing and into law enforcement. I love his books. But he said he likes to write about not what the cop does on the job, but what the job does to the cop. And that's what I wanted to show, my wide-eyed innocence when I first stepped into a cop car and the things that happened to me in that first year and how I evolved. So I couldn't get the story arc to work, so I put that first part in there. First part is just the way it happened. The second part is fictionalized to make the first part work. And I think the book came out far better than I planned it. So when you ask how I write that, I just started from the beginning and put those experiences that I had, linked them together, and just wrote it. And the way I write is I write with what I call a living document, Microsoft Word. So I'll start scene sequence off of each plot line. We'll transition back and forth across those plot lines as I move through the story arc. And then at the bottom, each time I do a chapter, I start a novel diagram at the bottom of my document. And so I can look at my novel at a glance. So chapter one, I'll say introduction, murder scene, you know, just something real quick to spark my memory. And then I write to a structure, conflict, complication, crisis, conclusion. So I can look down at my diagram below my manuscript and see right where I am in the book. So I never have writer's block because I always know where I'm going. Below that, I have a list of locations and a list of characters each time I add them, because I don't want to continually add characters. I want to pull the characters from the beginning of the book through the back, which makes it very difficult for the author, but it keeps the reader more connected because there's not as many characters. So it makes work for me to adjust the background and motivation for these secondary characters to be pulled through the rest of the book. And it's a lot of what a lot of authors call a Bible when you start a series is what I'm describing. So now I pick these up and I move them to the next manuscript, the next book. The next book is called A Lonesome Blood Red Sun. And I just drop that into the bottom of my manuscript document, and I could call that up. So now I'm on the third book I'm writing right now, and I just bump all those over. So I can look at a glance to see what I want to pull from those other novels, the names, locations, and have a reminder.
How do you decide what experiences you're going to write about? It sounds like this one's very much true story to you. So how do you decide which kind of events you're going to put in?
Well, that's the thing. I don't know what I'm going to write other than the three plot lines. Once I decide the three plot lines, then I could start the adventures or the events that I actually experienced. I can pull those out and plug them into motivations on that plot line. You see, I don't know if that's clear enough. But so for instance, I knew who the murderer was going to be in the book before I started it. I don't know how I'm going to get there. I don't know who he's going to kill. I just know who it's going to be. So that's one plot line. The other plot line is going to be the evolution of the character, Dave Beckett going through his machinations from innocent to experienced detective. And that's an easy plot line to facilitate. So each time I jump plot lines, I just decide I need a motivation. I need to show something here. And I just draw from my experience and then plug it in.
How much of you is going into Dave Beckett?
Well, the first half is, I'm telling you, is every one of those scenes actually happened. The fatal car crash, the murder in the Holiday Inn, the suicide, my mom coming out to the fatal car crash and trying to get my attention at the car scene, at the accident scene, all that. The officer involved shooting when I was just 21 years old, and I chased the armed robbery suspect and he grabbed a 5-year-old kid around the neck and held him hostage. I was by myself. All that stuff happened just the way I wrote it. First year on the job. And I folded all that in and made it work. And I'm getting some great comments that people love this book.
Well, you can see because it actually happened.
Yeah. And that's why it's so dynamic, is because I wrote it as I was standing there.
Well, that kind of crime doesn't happen in L.A. We know that can't be real. And so what's the most important thing that you want people to take away from a book like this? Is it pure entertainment and action, or is there something underneath it all that you kind of hope people pick up?
Well, I'm not trying. I don't want to put any politics into it. I'm writing for pure entertainment. And as far as theme, the themes are individual for the story. My main job is to entertain. So I am constantly thinking about how to endear the character. But I'm most conscious about the voice. The voice of the character is what the reader is in for, is what they're looking for. And that's the most difficult part of writing, is getting the voice right. So I'm paying strict attention to that as I'm going through.
So you love being a storyteller.
I always have been. I love telling stories. That's true.
So now, I don't want this to be too weird of a question, but as we talk to a lot of fiction writers and true crime writers and all sorts of stuff, how do you experience your character then? And even your little characters, your extras, so to speak, and that, how does the experience happen to you? Because, usually with nonfiction true crime writers, we get, there's no interaction like they're a person or a real person, but fiction writers quite often describe their characters like people, like their children, and they actually see them and hear their voices and the whole thing. So you kind of doing true story but fiction, how is it for you?
Well, that's what it comes back to, voice again. You know, there's three parts of voice, language and syntax, point of view, and then attitude. And when you're writing nonfiction, you can't get the most important part of voice because it's attitude. It's how the character reacts to what's going on verbally. And if it's the point of view character internally, and a nonfiction is more factual. So the reader reads for emotions. They want to feel the story through emotions. And that's why voice is so critical. And the reaction, and that's what I watch. I watch it very carefully, the motivation, action, reaction in each scene, in each sentence, in each paragraph. If you have too much reaction to a motivation, you get melodrama. And that happens quite a bit with some of the books that I read. So I'm careful to balance out my motivation and my reaction to the action.
Yeah. So what do you think about a lot of there's a lot of popularity lately in this type of action detective sort of book, and you get, like, you know, Reacher and John Wick and all these things have been kind of getting to the screen and series and stuff like that. Are you a fan of what's going on with a lot of them right now?
I'm still an avid reader. I powered down on my reading this year, but last year I read 150 books and I did reviews on Goodreads. I'm a pretty big presence on Goodreads. So I do follow what's going on. And most of the time, it doesn't matter what genre, because I read romantic comedies, I read sci-fi, fantasy, as long as it's well written and it follows some of the 16 precepts that I write by, I'm in. I'll read the whole thing. There are some authors, I don't want to disparage anybody, but some authors I read and they're just redoing the same thing over and over again, and they don't get to the emotional core of the character. Bruno Johnson is very vulnerable. Him and his wife Marie, they go after these children who are at risk. And when I was working, that's what happened. I wrote those 38 novels. I couldn't sell a book. And finally, I decided I'm going to write what I've been avoiding, because in my job, the worst call I went on involved children, and it was just difficult for me to deal with it. So I thought, you know, readers read for emotion. I'm going to put some emotion in these books. So the children don't get hurt or injured on scene. It's offset, so I don't want to scare away any readers. So Bruno Johnson feels those emotions for those children. And you're feeling it right along with him and his wife, Marie, and his father who rescued the children. And once I started writing to the emotions instead of writing the story, which is what a lot of these books you're talking about is strictly story. Story is not story. Character is story. I had that drilled into me by my writing mentor. And these books, most of these books are just stories. They're just telling the story, going through the process. And these stories are very good, but they're not getting down to the core emotions of it. Some of these characters, you have no idea what they're feeling. They're just going through and doing the action and moving on. Not Bruno. Bruno's not that way at all.
What's funny to me is that in my image of law enforcement is the ability to disconnect, not deal with your emotions, and you are connected completely with your emotions.
When I was working on the street and there were children involved, that was the only time I could not disconnect my emotions. If there was a crook that was shot and he signed up for it, that's what he made those choices. So I could almost deal with, without much difficulty, that this is the game that we're playing right now. But when children are involved, they don't get to make those choices. So, I had no problem going to mass shootings, everybody shooting each other. That was part of the game that they chose. But when children are involved, that's a different story.
Do you think that's why you write about the children in your books?
Yeah, I do, because it adds another layer for both, for Bruno and his wife and his father. They have to deal with all these other crimes or incidents like these other characters you're talking about, and deal with the children at the same time. So there's definitely an added layer.
I would imagine that each time you complete a book, there's something you get out of it. What does a book do for you?
Well, you know, I think it would change for me, but after I write the end on the end of the book, it's like a chunk of me is gone. It takes like 2 weeks for it to refill. It sounds kind of corny, but I feel like I'm at a loss because I'm always thinking about the book when I'm into it. Sometimes I'll have a problem that's working in my head and I don't even realize it. And I will wake up in the morning and there it is, because my mind has been working on it subconsciously. I know that sounds corny too, but that's the way it works for me. So when I finish a book, I have an emptiness for like 2 weeks until it fills in and I'm off to the next book. I usually have two other books going at once that I'm taking notes on for the motivations and plot lines before I start the book. I'm writing two at one time right now.
Yeah. And you're reading.
Yeah, and I'm reading, yes.
That's a little bit crazy, but that's all right. You know, I understand the writing part because I'm a savage at writing myself. I'm the same way. But since my eyes have gone, got cataracts and I had surgery and that, I'm reading less and I'm doing the audible a lot more, easier on the eyes. You know,
yeah.
Your characters and that, where did the characters come from for you? Or did this come out of the thin air? Or are there people you've kind of come across in your life and you've kind of developed them into characters?
Sometimes the characters are, most of the times, they're an amalgamation of several people. Like if it was a supervisor that gave me problems, I never had problems with supervisors except for one.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Really, and I would take different aspects of supervisors and combine them. And some of the bad guys, like in book two of Bruno Johnson, The Replacements, I wanted to write about the most dangerous person I ever ran into in 31 years. And the problem with that was this guy was such a sociopath, probably even a psychopath, that if I wrote him just the way he was in real life, he would be a caricature. So if I write a hero and I write him superhero, like some of these guys you were just talking about, I'm not going to disparage him. but I've got to get, like, if I write him as pure heroes, then they turn into caricatures, cartoons. So to make a hero not a caricature, you have to give him some flaws. And that's what a good character has. He has a multiple level layers. So when I was writing this bad guy, he was so evil that he was a caricature. So I had to give him some humanity. And what happened was I described him. I gave him a little bit of humanity. And the publisher picked the book up, the second book, right away. I wrote the second book, and I didn't like the guy. I didn't like him so much that I killed him in the third book. And I sent it into the publisher, and the publisher goes, "No, you can't kill Carl Drago. We love him." Well, that was my fault because I gave him too much humanity. and this guy, his name in real life was, and I'm not worried about giving this up because he's not going to be a reader. He's not going to know or listen to these podcasts. But his name was James Lawless. In real life, his name was James Lawless. And he had killed somebody, committed a murder, got 25 to life, did 12 years, got out, killed somebody else. He got out on parole, killed somebody else, went in, did 25 to life, got out in 12. So now he's done 24 years. The second time he got out, they figure he might be a threat to society, and they put my team on him to follow him around. This guy, he was tattooed from his chin all the way down to his toes, every part of his body, mostly with white hate type of tattoos. But he had a ram tattooed on his pelvis. The horns were on his hips, and the snout of the ram was his penis. He even had that tattooed. That's how bad this guy was. So it was easy for me to kill him off in the second book, in the third book, but they wanted me to bring him back. And so I had to humanize him even more. And now I'm carrying him through all the books. He's a sidekick of Bruno.
Sidekick of Bruno, as in he's a bad guy, or is he?
He is a rehabilitated bad guy that Bruno has helped rehabilitate. And, he comes in and out of the stories too. As a Bruno foil, somebody that Bruno leans on from time to time, because this guy is still a bad dude. So I do take from my career. I'll envision somebody that I dealt with, and I'll put him in the book. Like Whitey, Sinister. The Sinister was the book came together so tight. I was just stunned at how good this book came out. It got a star review in Publishers Weekly, which is hard to do. It's hard to get into Publishers Weekly, let alone get a star review. Was also an editor's pick for best mystery on Amazon. So it's a cranking book. And the character of Whitey, I took from somebody I knew in the jail. And I think that's why it works so well. I also gave Bruno a dog this time. And the dog almost has more intelligence than Bruno does. And people are really liking him.
But, you know, I wonder now, because I write a lot of nonfiction and true crime. So does Mike. But do you have problems getting into the mind of the bad guy, like someone like this, and putting it down on paper and putting it in words? Does it sort of get into your mind or soul, so to speak?
Well, like I said, voice is everything in writing. I mean, it is the everything, even in nonfiction. You as an author telling the story, you're putting your voice in there, and that is what carries the book. The bad guy, if I write first person all the time, I don't write third person. I did in one book, The Heartless, because I wanted to get into the point of view of this crook, and I had to actually displace myself and think like the crook in order to make that point of view work, because he couldn't think like Bruno and do the things like the crook does. So I had to think skewed in order to make it work. And in that book, I talked to a detective who worked for me, detective bureau. She was telling me about a boyfriend who had a shoe fetish. And I liked that idea. So I gave this crook a shoe fetish to make him stand out from other crooks in other books. So he collected high-end women's shoes and in the book. And the publisher liked it, but she had me power it down a little bit. I put too much of the high dollar, high-end shoes. So I had to take a step, because that's not my world, and I had to step into his world with, you know, his murderous thoughts and his shoe fetish and make it work. So yeah, it's fun to go there, but it's also a little bit scary sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, I would say, you know, and then your wife kind of come home and you got all these shoes sitting around there.
My wife reads my books and she says, I don't know what's worse, if you made this up or if it actually happened.
that's it. You know, I would just imagine, because in your job, it's really difficult to be doing that kind of work and not be judged. And you see that a lot now. I mean, you know, police and law enforcement and even personalities. Like I get tons of hate emails every week. And I couldn't imagine doing a job that you're trying to do like a policeman right now. So I don't know. I just think it's a difficult situation. I think because you have to kind of assess people in that job. And so when you're writing about it, you're kind of making an assessment of who's good, who's bad, and what they're doing. And in a way, it's judgment. And so it's I don't know. I think it's a difficult thing all the way around.
The whole thing is a judgment. Anytime you do anything out there, you're going to be judged. No matter what you do, you're going to be judged. And that's why I refused to talk to the press, not because I didn't want the story to get out, but because they would take it and write the story in their context and not the way I told it to them. They would shift it to their view, either on purpose or subconsciously. And I didn't go on with that. I didn't like that.
No, I agree. I you know, press were awful. I know.
Well, even Al, even producers, when you will go on to like a show, a documentary, and you get interviewed for that documentary, and next thing you know, what's on TV is slightly different than when you thought.
Yeah. You know, I had a whole high profile career. I was always getting into all kinds of problems, and I had real stories of What was it with the Bad Boys TV show? They wanted to ride with me, put the camera in my cop car. And I said, I'm not doing that. And then one time, real stories of high patrol, another incident, they wanted to get in my cop car. I said, no. Was one, I was called to a scene on purpose, I think, by this other deputy who took the cameraman in his car instead of mine. And so I get there and I'm trying to stay out of the shot. But at the end, this is what I didn't know. There's a cameraman and a producer there, and they actually gave me a line to say. If you read the credits on those TV shows, it shows writers' credits. Oh, it's supposed to be real life television, but they're telling us what to say. So, no, it's not.
No, there's always script in that, you know, because most of the reality, you have to have some actors and some script, and then you have the real characters, and you're hoping that the mix is what explodes.
Right.
But it's craziness, because it's in a way, you're playing on real people, and you're hoping that the outcome is what entertains people. But in essence, you're kind of making a mess, and you're kind of making fun of everyone, and you're making money through it. I'm not a fan of any of that stuff because of that.
Yeah,
it's taking away from, I think, what the point is of people getting a view of reality of the street, and I think that's sad, because we kind of wreck people's lives that way, and so. This is why I'm watching all the old shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, I can't stand being involved in too much of the reality right now, because it's just, I don't know, yeah. It's too now, and I can't understand a lot of it. So, that's but my issue. So let's get some real names here. So which people did you know? Which supervisor didn't you have a good time with? No, just kidding. now someone has never heard of you before, which with that many books, I'm not sure how that would be. But if someone hasn't heard of you before, what book would you tell them to pick up to read to kind of get the feel?
I try to write all the books as standalones, even though the characters continue to evolve and they continue to gain children as they go through the series. So you pick up the book, and it, without reading other books, you should be able to just dive right into it and not have a problem with it. And I write a thriller structure, not a mystery structure. So they're short, snappy chapters that pull you right along. Like I said, The Sinister right now is a very tight book. I think it's one of my best. But I wrote four books in Current Day. And then in the fourth book in Current Day, The Vanquished, I beat up and battered Bruno so badly, the publisher made a comment to me in post-production saying, well, I don't know how you're going to bring Bruno back from this. And I thought about that, because he was emotionally crushed in that book. I said, yeah, you're probably right. So The Innocence is actually a prequel. So I wrote four Current Day, and then I wrote four prequels explaining how Bruno came to be Bruno in book one. So it's like the Star Wars. So you can either start with The Innocence or The Disposables, depending on how you want to read them. Read them the way I wrote them, starting with Disposables, Replacements, Squandered, Vanquished, or go to start with Innocence in chronological time. But, pick up any of them. The Reckless was a particularly emotional book for me. I wrote about a good friend of mine who was killed in a line of duty on a search warrant, a dope search warrant. A 15-year-old kid shot and killed him on entry. And I wanted to give the reader the emotions of that story. So in order to do that, I had to motivate my friend who was killed. And so I wrote the book in a mystery structure for the first half, or the first 100 pages, and then I shifted to a thriller structure after that. And I sent the book in, and the publisher was, oh, we love this book, but you got to cut the first 100 pages. So
yeah.
So they saw that the shift in the voice and the structure, and they wanted to be a pure thriller, so they said cut the first 100 pages. And when you cut that kind of that number of pages, I had to rework the whole book. And The Reckless, because of that, came out to be a dynamite book too. That's a great book. That was my time in bank robbery when I butted heads with the FBI. We didn't get along that well at all. But my team took down a whole lot of bank robbers, and it was a lot of fun.
Do you think that's displayed pretty real when you see movies and TVs, or you in a lot of stuff, the way agencies like that react to people like FBI and police law enforcement? Do they really not get along, or do they get along? Like, is that kind of dealt with pretty real?
Anytime there are people involved, you got personalities, and personalities conflict. And so agencies conflict. There were interagency conflicts when I was working, you know, with Highway Patrol and the Sheriff Department. They'd get into a spat and they'd have a sit down and work it all out, or, you know, that kind of thing. But the FBI is a different animal because they like to Bigfoot the investigation, step in and say, yeah, this is ours. We're taking over. But I don't, if I had the choice of having a diehard county detective chasing me or an FBI agent chasing me, give me the FBI agent, because I'm going to evade him all day long and not necessarily that county deputy.
Let's see, there you've heard it here first. Yeah. No, I always find it interesting, because I think that's the key. I think what you said is, with any agency and any conspiracy I hear and all this stuff you hear flying around, mostly people don't take into account that they're just all human beings.
Right.
And, like all of this stuff, you have to really look at them as, well, this is a human being.
And I never realized that until I actually got into, when I started, being deep into the game of chasing crooks, and took a step back and started looking at the people that I was working with. And the first time I saw that was my first tour of the SWAT team, because I had this image from watching, you know, the SWAT TV show and you know, the different cop shows, how professional they work. And I get into the SWAT team and my life depends on those five guys on that stick going in on entry. And I realized that guy's dumb as a rock. The guy behind me, he's got a machine gun. You know what I mean? That's when I first realized this. It's not what you see on television. You think that everybody is professional. Everybody's going to do what's right. And you're going in a house with a guy, the lights are turned off, and he's laying sitting in a corner with a AK rifle, and you're going through the front door after him, and you got to depend on the guy that's in front of you and behind you.
Question. My editor yelled at me a little bit ago, this latest book I'm writing, because I forgot to add more female characters of strength. I think that's how she would put it.
Right.
Do you have issues with that, or do you try to put different type of people that are not you?
Oh yeah. I think female characters, I like writing them. I hope I'm writing well enough, because they add another layer of conflict. And in all my books, I have strong female characters. I do it on purpose. Yeah.
So you wouldn't get yelled at by my editor.
No, just me.
They like yelling at you. That's
Well, that might be too.
So some of my characters are bad female characters, but a lot of them are great, strong detectives, or like Marie. Marie is the one that keeps Bruno in line.
Is it difficult to get into the mind do you have any problems writing characters that are not you, female, or any sort of big difference from who you are?
When I shift from Bruno, because Bruno is really just an alter ego character of me, when I shift to Bruno's dad, I have to shift around, almost like change hats, and think the way he would think, because he is morally upright and always gives Bruno the right counseling. So that is a big shift for me when I go into his point of view. Same thing with Marie. Marie understands who Bruno is, and that once he gets missile lock on something, she can't stop him from doing what he's going to do. But she gives him good advice on how to do it, that kind of thing. And some of the kids are broken emotionally, and Bruno has to deal with them, with kid clubs, that kind of thing. So I got to put myself into their point of view. And that's another thing on my manuscript down below. I lost track of my kids. I would get a note from my editor, from the publisher, and saying, right here, you say you have 11 kids, and I think you really have 13. That kind of thing. So I actually had to go back and read all my books and make notes on all the kids. And then I wrote up a spreadsheet, and I sent it to the publisher so she could track them now from in future books. So, yeah, I got a lot of kids, characters to juggle. Then I got to bring new bad guys in each time. And so now I'm juggling old characters with the new bad guy characters. And it's like working a giant jigsaw puzzle every time. And I just love doing it.
Yeah, it sounds like you have a good time with it. And that's a lot of it too. If you love what you're doing, it's going to come out in what you do. Right. So, you know, political correctness.
Yeah.
Do you think about that in these times? Or not? You just go ahead and just kind of go with whatever. I mean, because out in the street, there's a lot of talk more online in media, but the reality is when you're on the street, you're on the street. Things are what they are, and people talk the way they talk, and things are. Mm-hmm. And so do you, it's pretty hard to.
But you see, there's two worlds. There's the actual world, and then there's the reader's world. And that's what I get back to. I teach a class on how to write a novel. And I'll get back to those 16 precepts of what a reader expects. Now, there's, for example, they talk about a clip in a gun all the time. Well, there's no such thing as a clip. It's a magazine. But it became a part of the nomenclature. You know, when we were in SWAT, if we asked for a clip, we'd get slapped because that's not equipment is equipment, and a clip is for M1 Grand in World War II, where it was an internal magazine, and you shoved the clip down into the gun, and when you fired the last bullet, the clip tinked and flipped out of the gun. You put another clip in. That's where the clip came from, and that's where I think it carried over from World War II. But somebody goes, I'm down to my last clip, and they got a handgun or they have a M4 rifle. Now, that's not correct. But it's correct in the forum that it's being used in, you see? So when you say politically correct, what is politically correct? The publisher did a survey on my books, and they said that my number one readers are women 55 and older. Because I put a little bit of romance in the books, and so I don't use overly vulgar language. I don't use any of the bad words. I work around it because I understand who my audience is. If I wrote it just like it happened in real life, as far as language, it would be more gritty, and I would displace some of those 16 precepts and push people away. So, and the books that I read now, a lot of authors, they try to put in their political point of view. And I write these reviews. I say, well, I may be with your political point of view and I may not be, but it doesn't matter. I get enough of that in real life. I'm reading for entertainment. I want to be immersed in a story and be taken to another place. And when you put those politics back in there, it jars me back into real life, and I don't like it. And I think that the authors that are the big names that are trying to put their political platforms out there are making a mistake, because you're, at the very least, you're alienating 50% of the people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I agree totally. I don't think there's a place for it. I think if something comes in organically, if it's natural, it's fine. But if you're actually doing it with an intent, it usually sticks out, and it's not as good.
Right.
You know, it takes away from the story. It takes you out of the story. So that's kind of that's a mistake, you know.
Yeah.
I have a question on that 50, women 50 and older. I think, Al, you were talking about some, in our nonfiction world with true crime, women are really a dominant kind of reader or, attracted to that kind of, even especially the serial killers.
Yeah, the everybody I do many Barnes & Noble book signings every year, and I talk to all kinds of readers, and these true crime podcasts are just wildly popular, and they like to listen to the investigations breaking down the crime stories on audio.
Now, do you like to interact on social media? Do you have social media accounts for readers? Do you have a website? Like, how do people get a hold of Dave?
My website is david@davidputnambooks.com. And my books are readily available on any of the websites, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. They're Audible, they're digital. And I love to talk to fans or anybody who wants to talk about writing or reading. I give a lot of recommendations on books that I like. You tell me a book that you like, and I could refer you back to any number of books that are similar that you're going to like. I'm all about reading, writing, and conversing. I'm not big on Facebook. I never did break into that. I'm not big on Instagram or Twitter. I do dabble in it once in a while, but usually just to reply to somebody. But if you send me an email through my website, I answer every one of them and continue to answer them. I'm helping crime writers every day. I get emails from people writing crime novels, and they need help either writing or on procedurals, law, ballistics, that kind of thing.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I've learned a lot. Now I'm going to write some crime books. And
remember, Al, 16 precepts. Remember, right. This is going to be awesome.
That's right. As soon as but I can only count to 10. I've only got 10. I don't know what I'm going to do. I might have to. Well, anyway, so now the new book, of course, is A Fearsome Moonlight Black, and it's The Bone Detective, a Dave Beckett novel. Now, our guest has been the author, David Putnam. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It was outstanding speaking with you, David.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.